Serendipitously, the embalming fixed the tissue, thus retaining the integrity of the bite. There's just no medical or forensic literature to support the notion that such intricate data could be preserved by the countervailing effects of a happy coincidence. After completing his analysis, West concluded that the marks on the wrist were indeed bite marks and that they had been inflicted by a human being. He billed Noxubee County $2,902.12 for his services and assured Willie Willie that he would make himself available once law enforcement officials had identified a suspect. Wednesday, September 19th. While Ernest Eichelberger's notes included lots of pointers on how to go about investigating a murder, including another mnemonic device that used the letters of the word homicide, there were no acronyms to remind him about the constitutional rights of the people he was investigating. Because Courtney Smith appeared to have been sexually abused, Eichelberger's suspicion naturally turned to the men who had access to her home on the night of her abduction. His method of investigation in this case was to arrest them, all of them, and then wait for the truth to come out. 4 days after Courtney Smith's murder, Eichelberger began making his arrests. The first was William "Slick" Mickens, a frail 44-year-old man who was married to Ruby Smith's sister Betty. Mickens was Courtney Smith's great-uncle by marriage. A heavy drinker, Mickens had a habit of touching women when he talked to them, which sometimes, intended or not, could be taken as a pass. That night, while Mickens was talking to Ruby Smith, her son William thought he got a bit too physical. William came to his mother's aid, and he and Mickens exchanged words. William went to a neighbor's to call the police, but the neighbor wouldn't let him use the phone. Ruby finally asked Mickens to leave. He agreed and walked home at around 11:30 that night. According to his wife, he arrived home about an hour later, still more than an hour before the window in which police believed Courtney Smith was murdered. For Eichelberger, the fact that Mickens was an alcoholic known to occasionally make unwelcome gestures toward women apparently made him a possible child rapist and murderer. As Mickens was talking to some friends on the street in front of his house on the afternoon of September 19th, Eichelberger pulled up and arrested him. Mickens would be the first of many. Thursday, September 20th. Late in the morning, the Smith family and friends gathered to say goodbye to Courtney at a graveside service at Brooksville Cemetery. They sang a hymn, said a prayer, and read from Scripture. Courtney's mother, Sonia, and her aunt, Shamilla, each read a poem. Sonia's was short, poignant, and painful. "Wherever you go, my love is close beside you. Wherever I go, you're with me. Whoever we are, we're never far apart, 'cause we're so much a part of each other." After the burial, the family convened for dinner at the home of Freddie Allen, Courtney's great-grandfather. That morning, the Jackson-based newspaper Clarion Ledger reported on Slick Mickens's arrest. Noxubee County Coroner Willie Willie told the paper that Courtney Smith had been raped, struck on the head, and cut near her mouth. The paper reported that Slick also coached Little League, which of course made the accusation all the more awful. The monster who had just raped and killed a 3-year-old girl had also had unlimited access to children. In fact, Mickens coached baseball with Courtney Smith's grandfather, Johnny Will Smith, who seemed to be in shock about the arrest. His occasionally inappropriate behavior around women notwithstanding, few thought Mickens was capable of this. Later that day, Mickens appeared on the evening news, handcuffed and marched into a jail cell, as the reporter described the heinous act for which he'd just been arrested. William Mickens suffered from seizures, back pain, high blood pressure, and anxiety. He was on disability. Because he couldn't work, he coached and volunteered. It was a rewarding way to pass the time, and it made him feel useful. Now all of Mississippi had just been told that he had raped and murdered his grandniece. Friday, September 21st. Before he became a police officer, Robert Williams spent 18 years introducing Woody Woodpecker cartoons and sketching whimsical animals. From 1958 to 1976, the children of Mississippi knew the portly, gentle Williams as Uncle Bunky, beloved host of Fun Time, a children's television show broadcast out of Columbus. The crazy animals were Uncle Bunky's trademark bit. Between episodes of Heckle and Jekyll and Huckleberry Hound, Uncle Bunky would stand in front of a large white pad of paper as children in the studio shouted out fantastically mixed-up creatures for him to draw. A cat's face on a giraffe's neck, on an elephant's body with the wings of a sparrow. He once boasted that every kid who appeared on the show left with a teddy bear and a Bible. Funtime hosted both black and white children, reputed the first such television show in Mississippi to do so. When he died in the summer of 2015, he was mourned across Mississippi as a beloved icon. Each Funtime episode featured about 12 kids, all of whom got to appear on camera. Some grew up to be powerful Mississippians. One of them was Forrest Allgood, the longtime district attorney for the state's 16th Judicial District, and the man who would prosecute LaVon Brooks. In the late 1980s, Lowndes County got a new sheriff, Ed Prescott, who had also been in children's entertainment before turning to law enforcement. In fact, for the first few months after Fun Time began in the late 1950s, Prescott played the role of a country bumpkin named Cousin Ed, co-hosting the show with his friend Uncle Bunky. Since Fun Time was canceled in 1976, Williams had been working with local police as a youth counselor, as a sketch artist, and even in narcotics. But Williams's former co-host and now sheriff suggested a new role. He wanted Williams to interview children who had been victims of or witnesses to violent crimes. "These kids listened to him," the sheriff would later say in a newspaper profile of Williams. "They'll open up to him, and the kids won't talk to just anybody, especially when it comes to something like abuse." Williams's previous career as a beloved children's entertainer might have made him seem like an ideal figure to console and comfort kids, particularly if it had been in the late 1970s, when many kids were likely to have remembered his TV show. But this new role wasn't about consoling children. It was about getting information out of them. "It's like this," Forrest Allgood said in the same newspaper profile. "If we don't know anything about it, we can't do anything about it. We need the kids to say, 'This man did this to me.' It's fundamental in getting any case started." As the dozens of wrongful convictions during the ritual sex abuse panic of the 1980s and 1990s attest, interviewing children about violent or sexual crimes is a complex undertaking. An interviewer must build rapport with kids, filter fact from fiction, be careful not to introduce known facts, and do it all while protecting the psyche of a traumatized child. A qualified children's forensic interviewer should have a background in psychiatry or therapy. Williams apparently had neither. He wasn't a forensic psychologist. He was a guy who drew wacky pictures and introduced cartoons. His methods weren't drawn from years of training or studying academic research, but from seat-of-the-pants intuition. "I'll sit down with them, draw for them," he explained to the Tupelo Daily Journal. "And before long, they're telling me everything, who's done what to them. It's amazing sometimes what happens when I sit down and draw a few cartoons." Noxubee County officials believed the only witness to Courtney Smith's abduction was her 5-year-old sister, Ashley. So on September 21st, Williams made the trip from Lowndes County to interview the little girl. His alter ego was still so well-known and beloved that even the official department transcript of the interview refers to Williams only as Uncle Bunky. No further explanation was necessary. Ashley Smith's first interview, she was interviewed again a few days later, was a mess, as one might expect from a confused and frightened 5-year-old. She frequently contradicted herself. She said things Williams and other investigators knew to be false. For example, she claimed that her Uncle Tony had pulled a knife on her sister's abductors. She later changed the weapon to a gun, In truth, he had slept through the abduction. She also made fantastical assertions that couldn't possibly have been true, such as that the man who abducted her sister fled on an airplane. A skilled interrogator should have concluded from Ashley's mishmash of contradictions, almost assuredly false memories, embellishments, and outright fantasies that she wasn't a reliable witness. Instead, Williams tried to make sense of a traumatized child who was clearly mixing what she may have seen with what she may have heard, all while adding details and enhancements from her own imagination. It was an understandable inclination. A young girl had been brutally murdered. Perpetrators of such crimes are generally caught quickly or not at all. It had been nearly a week. As the days went by, Ashley Smith increasingly became the last best chance at catching her sister's killer. In his interview with Ashley, Williams appears to have seized on various fragments of her answers he found plausible and ran with them, while disregarding the many implausible or false things she said. At times, he even introduced new facts while attempting to get her to clarify. Those new facts then became a part of the narrative. One example of this proved particularly damning for LaVon Brooks. Ashley said at one point during her initial interview that the man who abducted her sister had a quarter in his ear. Williams suggested to Ashley that she was referring to an earring. He pointed to a photo of someone wearing earrings and asked, "Like the earrings there?" Ashley responded, "Yeah, a earring and a quarter." Later, Ashley would add that Courtney's abductor took the quarter out and put it up my sister's ear. Wearing a quarter in one's ear is a fad that comes and goes in some Black and Latino communities. Perhaps Ashley had seen someone wearing one. Slick Mickens sometimes did. Perhaps she was referring to a magic trick she had seen, where a magician pulls a quarter from behind a child's ear. Wherever she got it, Williams proceeded with the interview as if when Ashley said quarter, she really meant earring. LaVon Brooks was one of the few men in the area who wore an earring. This is almost certainly why local law enforcement officials began to look at him as a suspect. On another occasion, Williams asked Ashley if the man who took Courtney had a mustache or whiskers on his face. She responded, "He had a Halloween thing on his face," clearly referring to a mask. Williams then asked, "Was it a stocking or a Halloween thing?" Ashley replied, "Stocking." Ashley had never volunteered that the abductor was wearing a stocking. She only adopted it after Williams introduced it, later adding that the man had taken the stocking off of his face and put it over her sister's head. Only that last detail, the abductor putting the stocking over Courtney Smith's head, made it into the summary of the interview that the sheriff's department then sent to prosecutors. The actual killer, Johnson, wore neither a stocking nor an earring. Ashley was also wildly inconsistent about the abductor's identity and about what happened after he took her sister out of the room. Among other things, she first said the abductor was a Black man named Siobhan. She then changed his name to Trayvon. She then told Williams that Trayvon went to college with her mother and had a 5-year-old son named Travis who often played with her. Later in the interview, Ashley said Trayvon had an accomplice. Later still, she claimed there were two accomplices, one Black and one white. Toward the end, she switched again and said the actual abductor was a white man named Clay. She then contradicted herself again by saying she knew Clay, claiming he was her mother's boyfriend and had been to her house. She added, "I ain't saw Trayvon before," just minutes after claiming she often played with Trayvon's son. The problem with Williams' interrogation of Ashley Smith isn't that a scared and confused 5-year-old told stories or had difficulty processing what she had seen. It was that after he was clearly aware that Ashley had a propensity to mix fact with fantasy, to confuse what she saw with what she had heard or made up, he not only was still willing to believe the parts of his interview with her that he wanted to believe, he guided her to confirm parts of her story to fit his conception of the crime. Prosecutors then took it all a step further by adopting only the portions of Williams's already selective account of the interview that fit their own narrative. Even still, it's notable what Ashley did not say in that first interview with Williams. She did not say the name LeVon or LeVon Brooks. In fact, of all her varied, often conflicting descriptions of her sister's abductor, none of them fit LeVon Brooks. The only similarity between LeVon Brooks and what Ashley Smith described in that first interview was that Brooks sometimes wore an earring. But it isn't at all clear that Ashley ever intended to describe an earring in the first place. The same day as that initial interview, the day after Courtney's funeral service, Ernest Eichelberger made a wave of new arrests. He arrested Courtney Smith's uncles, Tony, Ernest, and William Smith. He arrested William McCarthy, the friend of Ruby's who had stopped by that night to visit on the porch, and David Harrison, a friend of McCarthy's who had lent McCarthy his car. He arrested Sonia Smith's boyfriend, John Hodge, Robert Goodwin, a neighbor, and Lee Harris, a friend of Tony Smith's. All of these men, all black, were tossed into the Noxubee County Jail. Tony, Ernest, and William had just lost a niece, a young girl with whom they shared a house. Eichelberger wrote the same thing on the arrest paperwork for all of them. Suspicion of murder. There was another interview that day as well. Ernest Eichelberger interviewed Sonia Smith. In that interview, he asked her if she knew or had dated any men who wore an earring. She mentioned only one, LeVon Brooks. "They call him Tati," she said. "Who?" Eichelberger asked. "They call him Tati," she said again. Saturday, September 22nd. When Eichelberger received Uncle Bunky's report from his interview with Ashley Smith, one could see how he might have been discouraged. Of all the men he had arrested so far, none wore an earring, and none had a name resembling Trayvon. But now Eichelberger knew that Sonia Smith had once been involved with a man named LeVon, or Tati, and that man wore an earring. So he sent a deputy to bring Brooks in for questioning. When Brooks showed up for work at the Santa Barbara that Saturday night, someone told him that the police had come by the club looking for him. They wanted to speak with him about what he might know about Courtney Smith's murder. Brooks had heard about the child's death and felt bad for her and her mother, his ex-girlfriend. But he knew nothing about the murder. He thought the wisest and easiest thing to do would be to drive to the sheriff's office in Macon and straighten out the misunderstanding. He told his boss not to worry. Once everything was cleared up, he'd come back and work the evening shift as usual. He'd never see the Santa Barbara Club again. Eichelberger began questioning Brooks at 8:47 p.m., nearly a week after Courtney Smith was murdered. Brooks waived his right to an attorney and answered Eichelberger's questions voluntarily. He told Eichelberger that he had briefly dated Sonia Smith several months earlier. She lived with her grandmother at the time. He broke it off because Smith was too fast for him. She was seeing other men. He'd occasionally see her and her brothers at the club, and they were all polite and friendly to one another, but he hadn't been to her home in at least 5 months. Even when they were dating, he had only been inside her home a few times. They usually met at her cousin's place instead. He had never even seen the house where she currently lived. Brooks then told Eichelberger that for the previous 3 years, he had worked the door, bussed, and occasionally cooked at the Santa Barbara. On the night Courtney Smith was murdered, he said he had reported to work for his typical shift, working the door when the club opened at 8 p.m., doing odd jobs throughout the night, then cooking a bit as the night wound down. On that particular night, he said he left at around 2 in the morning. He provided the names of several witnesses who could vouch for him. In fact, those witnesses would say he left closer to 3 or even 3:30. Brooks was so forthcoming, he shortchanged his own alibi. But it apparently didn't persuade Eichelberger. At the conclusion of the interview, he told Brooks he was being detained for Courtney Smith's murder. Under Mississippi law, Eichelberger told Brooks he could hold him for up to 72 hours. Brooks would remain behind bars for 18 years. Sunday, September 23rd. 2 days after Robert "Uncle" Bunky Williams first interviewed Ashley Smith, Harry Alderson, chief investigator at the district attorney's office, asked him to interview her a second time. According to Williams's subsequent report, shortly before this second interview, which took place in a Comfort Inn motel room, Eichelberger had informed him that Ashley had picked LaVon Brooks from a photo array. Williams's task for the second interview was to confirm the identification and try to collect more details. It's clear from police records that Brooks was now the central focus of Eichelberger's investigation. Of the 6 photos Ashley was given, all appeared to have been taken recently. The photo of Brooks was old. The men in the other photos had closely cropped hair. Brooks sported an afro. Other than the earring, there was little reason to suspect Brooks. He had no history of sex crimes, no convictions, arrests, or allegations of abusing children. The suspicion certainly hadn't come from Sonia Smith. In her interviews with Eichelberger, she said she and Brooks were on good terms, and she gave no indication that she suspected him. In January 1992, she would file an affidavit stating that Brooks had never been to her new home, and that Ashley wouldn't have known Brooks, much less known his nickname. As far as she knew, Brooks had no meaningful contact with her children, even when the two were dating. Eichelberger would later say Brooks had always been his prime suspect, even before Courtney Smith's body was discovered. He claimed to have spoken privately with Ashley Smith the day after her sister went missing, and that during the conversation, Ashley identified a man named Tighty as her sister's abductor. As Eichelberger explained it, this is why he gave Ashley a photo lineup that included LaVon Brooks. But there was a big problem with Eichelberger's story. If the only witness to the kidnapping told him the name of the perpetrator just hours after the crime, even before the body had been recovered, it's baffling why Eichelberger would then arrest every man who had been anywhere near the house that night, but would not arrest Brooks. In any event, in his second interview with Ashley, Uncle Bunky Williams presented the girl with a second photo lineup he had prepared himself. He used the same photo of Brooks that had been used in the first lineup, but picked 5 different men for the other photos. Once again, all the others were men Ashley had never met, and all had closely cropped hair. She again picked Brooks. Williams then asked if she knew the name of the man she had just picked. According to Williams, Ashley replied, "Tighty. I don't know his nickname, I just know his first name. He used to come over to my mama's house and talk to her." According to Williams, Ashley then confirmed that her sister's abductor was wearing an earring, and that he had pulled a stocking over Courtney's head. 2 details that, again, were first introduced by Williams, not by Ashley. Ashley also provided a wealth of new information in the second interview. Nearly all of it was wrong. This time around, for example, she said the attackers left after abducting Courtney, but came back later with potato chips and drinks. They then got out of their car and taunted her with, "Nah, nah, nah, I got your sister." She also told Williams that Tighty had a bag of money in his hand. At this point, there was little reason to put much stock in anything she had to say about the night her sister was taken. Instead, police and prosecutors again took what they needed and ignored the rest. In its profile of Uncle Bunky that ran the previous June, the Tupelo Daily Journal began, "For generations, Robert Williams has been able to get children to say anything." That lead would turn out to be far more accurate than the author could have imagined. At about the same time Williams interviewed Ashley Smith for the second time, Eichelberger interviewed the man who actually murdered Courtney Smith. Justin Johnson, then 35 years old, had dropped out of high school in the 9th grade. He worked at the Bryan Foods meat processing plant in the town of West Point, about 30 miles from Brooksville. When Eichelberger questioned him, Johnson already had a few arrests on his record, at least one for a sex offense. He had been brought in as a suspect in this case because at around the time Courtney Smith was killed, several witnesses had seen his blue and white 1979 Buick Electra parked near the pond where her body was found. Johnson really didn't have an alibi. He said that after work on Saturday, he had gone to a club in Crawford. He left at around 12:30 a.m., went home, and went to sleep. Though he said witnesses could verify he was at the club, he had left the club alone, had gone home alone, and was alone during the window of time when Courtney Smith would have been abducted and murdered. Eichelberger read Johnson his rights and placed him under arrest. Next came what should have been a significant clue. Eichelberger asked Johnson if he'd ever been arrested. Johnson replied, yes, for a similar deal, attempted rape. He added that the arrest was not long ago. Between the sightings of his car, his weak alibi, and his criminal record, there was every reason for Eichelberger to immediately make Justin Johnson the focus of his investigation. But despite the arrest, no one ever showed Ashley Smith a photo lineup that included Justin Johnson. His brief conversation with Eichelberger would be the last he'd have with law enforcement about the murder for nearly 20 years. That's because, by all indications, by the time local law enforcement interviewed Johnson, they were already pretty sure that LaVon Brooks was the killer. They just needed Michael West to tell them they were right. At around 5 that evening, West drove to the Noxubee County Jail and took dental molds from 12 people. This is the procedure in which a dentist fills a mouth-shaped tray with plaster, then sinks a patient's upper or lower teeth into it. The dentist creates a model of the patient's dentition from the molds. The procedure is commonly used by orthodontists and cosmetic dentists, but it's also used by forensic odontologists or forensic dentists. The suspects from whom West took molds that night included all the men Eichelberger had arrested to date, plus Sonia Smith and a few others who lived or had been seen near the crime scene and consented to the procedure. That night, West examined the dozen dental molds and compared them to the tissue sample he had cut from Courtney Smith's arm. It didn't take him long. The next day, West told county officials that he had excluded all 12 people as the source of the bite. Among those West excluded was Justin Johnson. West was probably right this time, at least about Johnson's teeth not matching the marks on Courtney Smith's wrist. Johnson killed the girl, but his teeth couldn't have matched the bite marks Hain noted and West confirmed, because contrary to Hain's suspicions and West's assertions, they weren't human bite marks at all. When Johnson finally confessed to killing Courtney Smith nearly 2 decades later, he made no mention of biting the girl. Michael West has often claimed over the years that for every suspect he implicates with his bite mark testimony, he exonerates many more. In the Brooks case, he claimed to have exonerated a dozen people. But by the time West took those dental molds, between about 5 p.m. and 7 p.m. on September 23rd, Eichelberger no longer suspected any of the people from whom West was taking impressions. By then, by his own testimony, his chief suspect was LaVon Brooks. There is no record of Eichelberger telling West as much, but West frequently consulted with police and prosecutors before performing an analysis. If West and his groundbreaking forensics had indeed been valid, if his method was really the scientific marvel that he claimed it was, he should have never concluded that the marks on Smith's body were human marks. Assuming West was right about that, and subsequent forensic analysts were wrong, assuming they were human bites, then West should have implicated Justin Johnson and exonerated LaVon Brooks, the man the police would bring to him 2 days later. Instead, West did just the opposite. Monday, September 24th. On Monday night, at around 9:30 p.m., Ernest Eichelberger officially placed LaVon Brooks under arrest for the murder of Courtney Smith. Investigator Harry Alderson then interrogated Brooks. Alderson asked Brooks when he was last in the town of Brooksville. Brooks responded that he had been there a couple weeks earlier when he took his sister to the doctor. Alderson next asked Brooks if he was willing to take a lie detector test. Brooks replied, "Sure will. I will be willing to take the test tomorrow." He then agreed to answer more questions without first talking to a lawyer. Brooks also gave Eichelberger permission to search his home and his car, a non-operational Camaro, and have his body examined for any scratches and bruises. He voluntarily provided a hair and blood sample. Crime lab testing would later find several hairs from a black male in Courtney Smith's bed and on her blanket that didn't match anyone in her family. They also weren't a match for Brooks. Eichelberger then asked Brooks if he had ever been arrested in another state. Brooks replied that he had, in Alabama for grand larceny. Brooks not only volunteered that information, he overstated his crime. In April 1981, Brooks was convicted of second-degree theft in Pickens County, Alabama. He pleaded guilty and received a 3-year sentence, 2 of which were suspended. In September of the same year, he was convicted in Noxubee County of burglary, accessory after the fact, for helping a friend hide some cash and merchandise that the friend had stolen from a gas station. For that, Brooks was sentenced to 2 years behind bars. Those were mistakes of youth, committed in his early 20s. He had been clean ever since. Now 31, Brooks had a steady job. He had no ensuing arrests at all, much less for violent crimes, sex crimes, or crimes against children. But Eichelberger and Alderson had pegged him for this murder. They processed the arrest, then drove Brooks 2 hours to Michael West's office in Hattiesburg to make dental molds of his teeth. Tuesday, September 25th. Sometime early to mid-morning on Tuesday, Michael West called law enforcement officials in Noxubee County with the results of his analysis. In his opinion, LeVon Brooks was the only person on earth who could have made the alleged bite marks on Courtney Smith's wrist. A few weeks later, in a 3-paragraph letter to Alderson dated October 18th, West made it official. In the 2nd paragraph under the heading Opinion, West wrote, "The dental structures of one LeVon Brooks did indeed and without a doubt inflict the bite mark found on the body of Courtney Smith." That was probably more than enough for an indictment, but there was still the matter of the lie detector. The Noxubee County Sheriff's Office had neither a polygraph machine nor anyone trained to operate one, so at around 10:45 a.m., the head detective from the police department in Starkville came to Macon to administer the test to Brooks. Polygraph machines aren't really lie detectors, of course, which is why the test results aren't admissible in court. At best, they can detect when someone is nervous or uncomfortable. But there could be any number of reasons for nervousness or discomfort, not least of which would include being a suspect in the rape and murder of a 3-year-old girl. According to the analyst, Brooks failed the polygraph. That result was later confirmed by the FBI. Friday, September 28th. 8 days after arresting him, Eichelberger released William Slick Mickens on his own recognizance. On the release form, Eichelberger wrote that Mickens had been cleared through investigation of not being number one suspect. It wasn't exactly vindication, but it did allow Mickens to go home. Mickens never really recovered. His wife Betty later said that for the rest of his life, her husband felt as if he lived under a cloud of suspicion. It wore him down. After his arrest, he was told he could no longer help coach the local school's football and baseball teams. He was barred from coaching Little League. In fact, no one in the area would let him work with children at all. Little of that changed even after Brooks was formally charged. It just wasn't worth the risk. Mickens's drinking problem got worse. He ultimately died a broken man. William Smith also struggled with his arrest. He'd barely had time to mourn his niece before he was arrested for her murder. Many in the family and community never fully bought into LeVon Brooks as Courtney's killer. Smith had come home that night right around the time she was killed. He felt their suspicions, even if unstated. He grew despondent. Prior to that night in 1990, Smith had never been in trouble with the law. Afterward, he moved to Columbus and was arrested several times for various low-level offenses. He wound up homeless and eventually lost contact with his family. But of course, LeVon Brooks would suffer most of all. A failed polygraph, a stacked photo lineup, a botched interview with a 5-year-old, and Michael West's identification of Brooks's teeth were more than enough to seal his fate. Brooks was formally indicted for the sexual assault and murder of Courtney Smith. District Attorney Forrest Allgood announced that he'd be seeking the death penalty. Shortly after the murder of Courtney Smith, some in the community raised concerns about her surviving siblings, Ashley and Patria. After some complaints to the local social services organization, the two girls relocated to the home of their paternal grandmother, Marion Smith. Smith also lived in Brooksville. She had a large, clean home and plenty of food. All were enough to convince the social workers that she could provide a better home for the girls. But the transition was hard on the girls, particularly on Ashley, who was old enough to feel the loss of her sister. Whatever she may or may not have seen that night, in the days since then, she'd certainly heard enough to know to be scared. In order to help the girls cope for the first few nights, Marion Smith gave up her bedroom and moved to the couch in the living room. The children would then beg their grandmother to get in bed with them until they fell asleep. Even then, she remembers, the slightest shift or noise would startle the girls awake, after which they'd cry out for help. One night, about a week after Courtney's murder, and just 2 days after LaVon Brooks had been arrested and charged, Smith had finally gotten the girls settled when all three of them heard a terrifying noise. Someone was trying to break into the house. Whoever it was first tried the window. When that didn't open, the prowler moved around to the side door. The girls woke with a start and then froze with fear. Marion Smith grabbed a butcher knife and ran outside. The prowler scurried away. She hurried back inside and called the police. Chief Russell showed up a few minutes later at her door. After reprimanding her for taking matters into her own hands, he circled the house, but found nothing. It was an awful ordeal for the children, but it also made Marion wonder. By then, LaVon Brooks was behind bars. What if whoever had murdered Courtney was still out there? Did the prowler target her home by sheer chance that night? Or did he know that two young girls were asleep inside? About a year after Courtney Smith was murdered, Verlinda Monroe fell asleep with her clothes on in the bedroom of her trailer in Crawford, Mississippi. At around 2 a.m., Monroe woke to the terrifying sensation of someone or something touching her stomach. The room was dark, but she sensed a figure hovering over her. She let out a scream and heard the figure bolt toward the door. Monroe's brother woke in the next room and flipped on the lights, just in time to catch a glimpse of a man fleeing the trailer. He gave chase, but couldn't catch up to the prowler. When Monroe looked down at her stomach, she saw that her pants had been unbuttoned and unzipped. Fortunately, Monroe's brother had seen enough of the fleeing man to recognize him. He worked with him at the Bryan Foods chicken plant. It was Justin Albert Johnson. Johnson was arrested and charged with burglary of an occupied dwelling. He bonded out a few days later. Chapter 2. The Murder of Christine Jackson. Beware of false prophets, which come to you in sheep's clothing. Matthew, chapter 7, verse 15, King James Version. Saturday, May 2nd, 1992. Gloria Jackson had gone out to a club, the Santa Barbara, of course, the only game in town. This time, there was no LaVon Brooks to take the cover charge or to cook at the end of the night. He was 3 months into his life sentence for the murder of Courtney Smith. Gloria had left three of her children in the care of her boyfriend, Kennedy Brewer, including 3-year-old Christine. For several months, Brewer and Jackson had been living together in a ramshackle house on Pilgrim's Rest Road, which wasn't so much a road as a graveled country lane in the further reaches of Noxubee County. Gloria Jackson wasn't a particularly attentive mother. She was young, and she'd had some mental health problems. Social services had been called to the house on a number of occasions to check on the children's welfare. The kids were often dirty and hungry, and she sometimes left them unattended. The house wasn't much to look at, or really to live in. Most of the time, the five residents spent their time in two rooms, having relinquished the others as too dirty to use. The front door had no lock. They kept it shut from the inside with a bent nail. Brewer was the more responsible and capable of the two, but not by much. He was only 19 and underemployed. For the most part, his efforts consisted of bringing the children to his mother's and sister's houses from time to time to get them fed and bathed. Shortly after Gloria Jackson left for the evening, Duane Graham and LaShone Williams dropped by the house. The two young men lived just down the road and were close in age to Brewer. Graham's grandmother was Jackson's landlord, and from her house next door she kept an eye on comings and goings. That night she noticed Gloria Jackson leaving and was concerned that the children may have been left by themselves, so she asked her grandson and Williams to check on them. At around 9 p.m., Graham and Williams went down the road and around to the side of the house, to the bedroom window, in order to get Brewer's attention. The three young men talked for 25 minutes or so, until Graham's grandmother yelled at him to come home and wash the dishes. Before they left, they made plans with Brewer to get together later that evening to watch television. After Graham finished his chores, he left his house and went back to see Brewer. He met up with Williams along the way. The three sat out on the front porch for a few minutes, then went inside to watch American Gladiators. Both Graham and Williams remembered seeing all three children asleep on the bed. The three young men hung out until shortly before midnight. Gloria Jackson came home from the club at around 12:30 a.m. Brewer had locked the door with the nail, and Jackson didn't want to knock and wake the kids. So, just as Graham and Williams had done, she walked around to the side of the house to the same bedroom window where Brewer was sleeping. She called out to wake him. He let her in the front door. Brewer and Jackson had sex and then chatted for a few minutes in the other room before returning to bed and going to sleep. Christine slept on a pallet at the foot of the bed. When asked to look back on his crimes 20 years later, Justin Johnson said his actions that night felt spontaneous, out of his control. He was out late, walking by himself down Pilgrim's Rest Road with nothing to do and nowhere to go. He'd been staying with his parents since he moved back home from Crawford. They lived about half a mile as the crow flies from Kennedy Brewer, Gloria Jackson, and the kids. Johnson couldn't say what drew him to that house just off of the road, nor could he say what drew him to the broken window, or what made him quietly lift it up, reach in, and pick up the small girl from her pallet on the floor. But that's what he did. He did it all without waking either her or the adults sleeping on the bed next to her. He then cradled the girl in his arms and carried her into the night. Johnson walked across the fields behind the house toward a patch of woods by the creek. That's when the girl woke up. He let her down, and she started walking with him, holding his hand. The voices in his head grew sinister. They told him to sex molest her and hurt her and dispose of the body. He'd later say that he didn't want to harm the girl, but he didn't know what to do. The two sat down, and the girl fell asleep. Johnson began to cry. He sobbed and beat the ground with his fists. Then he gave in to the voices. He took her clothes off and pulled out his penis. She woke up and began to cry. She told him, "You want my mama." Fearing her cries would be heard, he took her closer to the creek. There the voices told him to teach her. He penetrated her and quickly ejaculated. She told him she was cold. The voices went away and his mind began to clear. He'd later say that this is when he realized what he had done and began to cry all over again. The two of them sat there for a while, until the voices returned and told Johnson to dispose of her body. He obeyed. He walked her closer to the creek, picked her up by the waist, and cast her into the water. It was a deep pool, and she quickly slipped under. She tried to climb out, but the sides were steep and slippery. After a few minutes, he jumped in, but her body had already washed downstream. 2 decades later, investigators would ask Johnson if he kept anything of Christine Jackson's as a souvenir. "Of course not," he answered. "I'm not a pervert." The temperature had dipped into the upper 50s. Johnson was wet, muddy, and cold. Yet after killing the little girl, he stayed in the woods for a long time. He couldn't remember how long, but at some point, he'd say later, the voices finally told him to go home. Sunday, May 3rd. It was an unusually hot and humid day for late spring. Sundays in Nakshibi are given to preparing for church and then convening afterward for food and fellowship. In the small church at the head of Pilgrim's Rest Road that Brewer's mother and her family attended, it is often an all-day affair. Annie Brewer, Kennedy's 49-year-old mother, rose early. She had just finished preparing that evening's dinner and was sweeping the covered outdoor porch when the telephone rang. She answered and heard the distressed voice of one of her daughters. "Christine is missing." Christine and her brothers and sisters spent a good deal of time with Annie Brewer and her extended family. Christine wasn't Annie Brewer's granddaughter. Gloria and Kennedy got together after she was born, but she and the family treated her as if she were. Christine was small for her age. Though she had a head full of curly hair, she still had her baby fat, much of which remained in her face, particularly in her cheeks. She was tentative and bashful. She spoke quietly, and only to the people she trusted and to whom she was closest. So when Annie Brewer heard the news from her daughter, she felt in her bones that something was wrong. It would have been unusual for Christine to wander off by herself. The girl wasn't bold or assertive enough to do such a thing. Ruby Brewer, Kennedy's older sister, who also often took care of Christine, felt the same way. "She would stay up under you," Ruby recalls. Annie Brewer jumped in the car. When she arrived at the house a few minutes later, a few dozen people from the neighboring houses and trailers had already arrived to help with the search. Later there would be a lot of speculation about how Kennedy Brewer and Gloria Jackson acted that morning. It's a common phenomenon to assess guilt or innocence based on a suspect's behavior. It's also fraught with hazard. Innocent people can appear to be withdrawn or disinterested. Guilty people can appear distraught and victimized. These sorts of observations are also necessarily based on eyewitness observations, which themselves are influenced by biases, suggestion, and the witness's own emotional state. Unsurprisingly, then, some witnesses claimed that Kennedy Brewer and Gloria Jackson were both frantic that morning, worried sick over the whereabouts of the little girl. Others said Brewer kept busy searching while Jackson sat sullenly on a neighbor's porch. Still others said that Brewer acted as though he couldn't be bothered to search in the rising heat, and never strayed much beyond the edges of the house. Supporters of Brewer and those allied with Jackson turned on one another almost immediately, and opinions about how Brewer and Jackson acted that morning split mostly along family lines. Soon the volunteers had thoroughly searched the small house and surrounding area. They had ruled out any likely nearby hiding places. They then began to fan out across the fields and cow pastures that abutted the house. Others hiked down toward Horse Hunter Creek, a small stream that meandered through the area in a southeasterly direction, carving its way through the pastures. By the time Deputy Sheriff Bud Permenter arrived at a little after 8 a.m., at least 2 dozen people had been searching for Christine for nearly an hour. There was no trace of her. Because he saw no signs of forced entry, and because the house was locked from the inside, Permenter decided early on to focus on the 2 people who had last seen the girl, Brewer and Jackson. Neither could explain how Christine could simply vanish, so Permenter suspected one or both had to have been involved. If Jackson didn't see the girl when she got home, Brewer was his likely suspect. If Jackson had seen the girl, they were both suspects. For the short term, it would be the latter. Jackson told Permenter that she last saw Christine just before she went to sleep, when Brewer picked the girl up off their bed and placed her on a pallet on the floor. By the time Permenter had finished interviewing the couple, tempers were flaring, both between Brewer and Jackson and between the two families. Permenter placed Brewer and Jackson in his patrol car. He'd later say it was because he was worried about their safety. He cordoned off the house and checked the interior and exterior, looking for any signs of forced entry. He noticed the bent nail that kept the door shut. The other door to the house was boarded up. The only window that could have offered access to the child was the broken one in the bedroom. Permenter went into the bedroom and inspected the bed. There was bedding and clothing strewn about, which he recovered and bagged for evidence. The bed itself was still shoved against the exterior wall. The window sat toward the bottom of the bed, along the wall and at about the same height as the top of the mattress. This is where Jackson said she went to wake Brewer up. The window's lower section was broken. There was a gap of about 1 square foot. Beneath it was Christine's pallet with the blanket pulled back. Permenter went back to the patrol car and asked Jackson and Brewer about the broken window pane. They both told him that the window had been broken when they moved in. He searched the rest of the inside of the house, but found nothing of any obvious evidentiary value. On the home's exterior, Permenter found no indication that someone had come in or out, no footprints, and no sign of any kind of disturbance or forced entry. Permenter was soon joined by Ernest Eichelberger and then Sheriff Albert Walker. Both men also investigated the scene, inside and out, and, like Permenter, found no sign of forced entry. All of the officers later reported that the plants beneath the window were undisturbed. They saw no footprints leading toward or away from the window, and still no sign of Christine. Monday, May 4th. A dog team arrived in the morning. Oddly, the handler, a volunteer officer from Newton County, first gave the dogs a piece of Kennedy Brewer's clothing, not a piece of Christine's. The handler would later testify that the first dog was spooked by a large hog and refused to track. The second, he'd say, headed toward the creek and appeared to have been onto a scent before tiring in the heat. The third dog was the only one to actually track a scent from Christine Jackson's clothes. The handler and dog worked their way down the creek bed, in and out of the vegetation, until they came to a pool of water. At that point, the dog tried to go into the pool, started pawing the water, as her handler described it. The dog then put her head down in the water, and, in other words, she knew something was there, but we couldn't see nothing. The handler would later testify that he could see a small opening from the field leading to the water and caught a glimpse of a slip mark in the muddy bank on the opposite side. He made a mental note of it, but the dogs were tired and it was getting late. The search was called off for the evening. 2 days had passed, and there was still no sign of Christine Jackson. Wednesday, May 6th. On Wednesday morning, Noxubee County brought in a helicopter from the Meridian, Mississippi Naval Base to assist with the search for the little girl. Permenter and a couple members of the dog team boarded the helicopter and flew out to the scene. They approached the south end of the creek and flew north to the vicinity of the wide spot in the creek, the pool, that had excited the dogs the day before. Someone on the helicopter then spotted something in the water, but couldn't quite tell what it was. They hovered over the area until the prop wash blew the water off to the side. That's when Christine Jackson's body finally floated to the surface. The deputies recovered her body from the water and turned it over to the county coroner. The coroner then sent it to Stephen Hain for an autopsy. Permenter had now identified the two people who were with Christine when she was last seen alive, but he was still missing a motive. Why would the couple cover up the abduction and likely murder of a 3-year-old girl in their care? Did they play a role in her disappearance? The similarities to the rape and murder of Courtney Smith couldn't have been lost on him or the law enforcement authorities around him. Less than 2 years after Smith was killed, another little girl in the same area had been abducted from her bed and was now missing. At a later court hearing, one of Brewer's lawyers asked a law enforcement officer if the abduction and murder of Courtney Smith had any effect on the way they investigated Christine Jackson's disappearance. He answered without hesitation, it had not. And why hadn't they even considered the possibility that the two crimes were related? It was simple. LeVon Brooks was the man who raped and murdered Courtney Smith, and LeVon Brooks was still under the control of the Mississippi Department of Corrections. But that answer wasn't completely accurate. Initially, local officials had considered a connection. Just as in the Brooks case, local police had gathered everyone who had been in contact with the victim during the previous 24 hours. The two young men, Graham and Williams, Gloria Jackson, and another male, James Clayton, an off-and-on boyfriend of Jackson's. They then added one additional suspect, Justin Albert Johnson. Years later, Andre Degree, now the Mississippi State Public Defender, would have several conversations with law enforcement officials in Noxubee County about those early days of the investigation. The officials told him they knew that Johnson had been a suspect in the Brooks case. They also knew that within the last few years, he had twice been charged and convicted for attempted sexual offenses against women, both of which involved breaking into their homes. They also knew that Johnson lived in a small green clapboard house less than half a mile from Christine Jackson. Parmenter rounded up all of his early suspects and transported them to Noxubee General Hospital, where they submitted to an examination. A nurse collected blood, saliva, and urine samples from each, as well as body, scalp, and pubic hair. Each suspect was also examined for any lacerations or bruising. Neither Brewer, Jackson, Graham, Williams, nor Clayton had any noticeable scrapes or scratches. But one suspect did, all over his arms, Justin Johnson. When the nurse asked Johnson how he got the scratches, he said they were self-inflicted. But the authorities had already homed in on Kennedy Brewer. He continued to protest his innocence and insisted that he knew nothing about Christine's disappearance. Perimeter told Brewer there was one surefire way to clear his name. He could consent to go with law enforcement to Hattiesburg to see Dr. Michael West, who would make molds of his teeth. If he was telling the truth, Perimeter said, West would clear him of any blame. And so Brewer went with Noxubee County officials to Hattiesburg to see West, along with Graham, Williams, and Gloria Jackson. Justin Johnson was never asked to submit a dental mold. Friday, May 8th. As with Courtney Smith, Christine Jackson's body was sent to Stephen Hain. From his autopsy, Hain concluded that Jackson had been manually strangled. He also found that she had been sexually abused, so violently that she suffered a laceration from the bottom of her vagina to her rectum. Hain concluded that the injury was most consistent with forceful penetration by a male penis. More critically, Hain noted a number of other injuries, abrasions on Christine's arm, forearm, hand, and fingers. The abrasions were small, from between 3/8 of an inch to about 5/8 of an inch long. As with Courtney Smith, Hain thought these were bite marks, and after he communicated his suspicions, Michael West was brought in to conduct additional analysis. That transfer was easy. West was already at the morgue, assisting Hain throughout the autopsy and examination. Less than a week after taking the dental molds from Brewer, Graham, and Williams, West concluded his examination. His findings were definitive. In a letter to Noxubee County Law Enforcement, West wrote that the bite marks found on the body of Christine Jackson were indeed, and without doubt, inflicted by Kennedy Brewer. Wednesday, May 20th. Less than 2 weeks after abducting, raping, and murdering Christine Jackson, Justin Johnson entered a Lowndes County courtroom. He stood accused of the attempted rape of Verlinda Monroe about a year earlier. He pleaded guilty to burglary with intent to commit sexual battery. He was sentenced to 10 years in the Mississippi Department of Corrections, with 4 of those years suspended. He was then taken into custody and transferred to Parchman Penitentiary. he'd serve 6 years before he was released. About 16 months later, in September 1993, Kennedy Brewer was finally arraigned and charged with capital murder for the rape and killing of Christine Jackson. District Attorney Forrest Allgood announced that he would seek the death penalty. By that time, Michael West had